Living from Vision would like to present Dr. Robert C. Beck on the Brain Tuner.
Paul Tyler, who was at that time the chief of the Defense Nuclear Agency, Radiological Defense, usually picks me up at the airport in Washington and takes me back to the plane. And last February, he said, "Bob, did you see the article in the January Omni magazine on Meg Patterson's magic black box?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, aren't you interested?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, while you're out in California," he said, "why don't you look her up and see if there's anything we can do for her to get this thing broken loose and into the mainstream?" Now, this was an honest effort by Paul Tyler, who attends all of these conferences, to be of assistance to Meg, because he was aware of the work that she had done with Ifor Capel at the Curie Institute and a number of other workers. So when I got to Los Angeles, I gave her a call, introduced myself, said that the fellow who is in charge of this stuff for the Food and Drug Administration asks if he can extend any courtesy in helping you to get either type approval or what have you. She said, "Well, I cannot talk to anyone. I have contractual arrangement with the NET, Neuroelectric Therapy Group," and at that time they were near the John Wayne Airport, "but under the circumstances we can call a meeting." Well, this was perhaps one of the most remarkable meetings I've ever attended in my entire life. At one end of the table was the principal investor, who at this time had raised about $3.5 million to develop the black box brain tuner, the neuroelectric therapy device. There were three of the staff scientists and the president of the financial company called TLC. very bad analogy. It was, the middle word was leverage corporation. I think it was Turner Leverage Corporation or something. It had nothing to do with tender loving care. Meg had been brought to this country in August of 1981 to develop a device which had been built for her by Shackman Instruments in England, which was an outgrowth of the original Wen work. And I brought some of these instruments here in case we have any technical types to actually show you what they look like. The history of this is that Meg Patterson, while working as an abdominal surgeon at the Tung Wah Hospital in Hong Kong, had come across Dr. Wen, W-E-N, and his use of electroacupuncture for anesthesia. And Dr. Wen had discovered, quite accidentally, that many of his patients were on heroin. At this time, 1970 to 72 in Hong Kong, a $500 a day habit in the United States would cost less than a pack of cigarettes in Hong Kong. And about 20% of the gross population that would go through the Tung Wah Hospital in Hong Kong, Kowloon, were heroin addicts. So he, doing hundreds of surgeries a month, a certain percentage of these people who were heroin addicts began to report, "I'm not feeling any discomfort. I don't have withdrawal pains. I seem to have an altered state." They would go back on the street after surgery, get a fix from their usual mother, and find that the fix had not given them the same effect. There were a number of fights because they thought their heroin was being cut, etc. But it was a very interesting political situation. So Dr. Wen did what any cool scientist would do. He began doing rat studies. Now, mega rats. Right. I'll digress for a moment here and say that heroin, or opiates as a class, opium, morphine, heroin, and a number of the synthetics that are manufactured in the ethical pharmaceutical houses, simply overload the body's production of normal endorphins. Beta endorphin was discovered around 1975 as a painkiller that the body manufactures that is about 100 times as effective as morphine as a painkiller. When you don't have it, you get the aches and pains, the withdrawal, the stomach cramps, the nausea, the insomnia, all of these horrible things that attend withdrawal. When you give your body massive doses, or even small doses in the beginning, of any of the opiates, the part of the brain that says build neurotransmitters simply says shut down, we have too much. So when you get off of the substance, when you try to kick it cold turkey, the body is in agony because those little factories in the brain simply don't produce the endorphins. The word endorphin comes from endogenous orphan after morphine. It simply means endogenous or built-in morphine. About 5 or 6 years ago, there were some 40 known neurotransmitters, serotonin being one of the most famous. At this time, there are over 2,000 that have been identified, and they're still counting. So the brain is an exceedingly complex little factory. Remember the days in school when they said, well, you're worth about $5. You've got 2 pounds of salt, some potassium, some carbon, some hydrogen. Try to buy some a gram of interferon for under $8,000 or $10,000. The body is far more complex than this set of chemicals that we held so dear in grade school. What Dr. Wen did was to hook the rats on heroin, have two groups, one control and one active. He would cut off the heads of the rats and run chromatography, electrophoresis chromatography, to find out what some of these trace proteins were in the control and the sample. The rats who had been hooked on heroin and suddenly cut off, that were pretty miserable rats, showed that it took maybe a week to 3 weeks before the neurotransmitters would again reappear, the exact range of time that the withdrawal symptoms occupy somebody coming off of a narcotic. The rats, which were taken totally cold turkey off of heroin, which had been stimulated with two little clips, and I have the photographs of all this in the documentation, fascinating work, and were given electrostimulation at around 111 hertz, and we'll talk about this later, showed that within 40 minutes of the time that the voltage was applied, the brain's ability to produce its own neurotransmitters had been rehabilitated, and that within 3 to 5 days it had reached normal. Now, the implications of this were rather stunning. How many people do we have in this country who are on Valium, Librium, uppers, downers, legal narcotics that are highly addictive? You probably remember that during the Civil War, American Civil War, when morphine was invented to replace some of the other opiates, they said, oh, here, we have a painkiller that's totally non-addictive. They've said this about almost every other drug that has seen the light of day. In fact, boys and girls, if it isn't addictive, they don't want to sell it. Did you realize that there is a $13.6 billion legal pharmaceutical trade in mood-altering drugs such as Valium and Librium, and that there is about a $20 billion market from the same drug manufacturers in the United States that export it to Mexico, where they do not have these tight pharmaceutical controls, prescription, which comes back onto the streets of the United States? That is close to $36 billion a year at the retail level. Now, nobody wants to interrupt this trade. Tobacco, which is 4.5 times more addictive than heroin, this study was done here at the Veterans Administration Hospital, Sepulveda, by Dr. Krover in 1974. It had been found that GIs coming back from Vietnam, who had several habits, tobacco, heroin, others, could be gotten off of heroin within 72 hours to a week, but it was almost impossible to get them off of tobacco. So a study was done which established that the withdrawal time on tobacco could run up to 2 years, that it was 4.5 times more physically addictive than heroin. This is hardcore scientific data. Would you like to see the American tobacco industry stop paying taxes? Their net is around $27 billion a year. Now, if we look at the liquor industry, where 90% of the drinking, the alcoholic consumption in dollar volume, is consumed by 10% of the drinking population, these are big dollars. People ask why these devices are not exactly legal in the United States. Well, getting back to the story, we came to this conference table hoping to exchange some information. I passed along to Meg and the rest of the people who must remain nameless, but this is thoroughly documented, the fact that Paul Tyler was willing to assist this group in getting this device going. Now, she had been in this country since August of 1981. They had raised $3.5 million to build a prototype. At the time that I met with these people in February of 1983, not one device had been built.
Why was that?
We'll get to this very soon. So I asked them, how's your patent status? We realize that once we patent it, we've given the secret away, so we plan on using the strategy of continuance in part, if you know what this means. In other words, they would continue to modify the patent as long as possible with continuations, amendments, so as not to get a patent. That meant that they had no patent. Well, what is the status of your prototype? Well, we are yama, yama, yama. Well, are you going to sell these devices? We don't know. We think we're going to lease them. Well, how much? Well, we'll put a price tag of about $50,000 on each box, and the doctor will be on the franchise agreement, I have a copy of this in case anyone doubts it, required to charge the person $8,000 if he has no insurance for 10 days use of the box, $10,000 if he has insurance coverage. I have the letter here that went to the franchisees. And yet they had no boxes. A number of people had bought territory for this, including William Parker of the Parker Holistic Health Center and a number of other people that by this time I had met. They had been promised delivery of the brain tuners by December of 1981. And here we are into 1983, and not one box had ever been delivered. Some strange things were happening here. And after listening to this for about an hour, I was prepared. I'd armed a briefcase. I had devices which I had acquired, had smuggled into the United States from the USSR, from Finland, from Germany, from England. I still have some of these. We have the original devices, I brought several of them tonight, that had been used by Dr. Wen in Hong Kong, in other words, the grandfather of the Shackman instrument device that Meg had used at the Pharmacon clinics in England. So it turned out that the investors who were at this table were not even aware that this technology was over 100 years old, had been used in the Soviet Union for over 20 years, had been used on the continent for 15 and in Great Britain for 10. They thought that they had an original idea which might have been patentable, etc. These devices could absolutely rock the boat of the pharmaceutical drug industry, the liquor industry, the tobacco industry, the doctors who make a great deal of money. When you want the prescription refill, usually you have to pay the doctor a fee. It's just a mess. Why are these not being used, for example, in alcoholic rehabilitation centers? I'll digress with another storyline, and all of this will converge in a moment. In 1969, some more friends of mine, new friends, I didn't meet these people until I started researching this area, had heard about the generic term electrosleep that was being used in the Soviet Union for addiction and alcohol control. The government gave these people a little money sent them to the Soviet Union, and they came back with one of the original devices that was used for, quote, electrosleep. It seemed that the Soviets had trouble with generals who drank too much vodka. And at this hospital in Washington, which is a household word, they were treating American generals who had the habit of too much scotch, bourbon, or vodka, or gin. They brought the device back to the United States in late 1969, early 1970, began using it in the hospital with addicts. This is thoroughly documented. It's one of the most fascinating psychopolitical stories that emerged during the 5 months that I was actually researching this data. The CIA came around and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, we have this electronic device, which apparently is restoring brain function in Korsakoff psychosis, which means loss of short-term memory." CIA said, "You can't do that." The people who were working on the project were dispersed, took the device to Garland, Texas, to the Vero Instrument Company. Now, Vero builds the high-technology equipment like Hughes does, the Glomar Explorer. Vero builds skunkwork devices like starlight scopes, infrared viewers, high-technology microcomputers. They're one of the highest-tech government secret agency suppliers in the world. The vice president of this company split off, founded a corporation called Neurosystems Incorporated, which is in the telephone book in Garland, Texas, and brought out a beautiful little device, which until recently was the Cadillac of the entire field, about the size of a pack of cigarettes, that absolutely cured addiction. They thought, wow, we're going to have markets for this. They never got FDA approval. That's been 14 years. FDA grandfathered them under Section 510 K and B of the 1976 Congressional Act. They still said, hey, if we take this around to dry farms, namely alcoholic rehabilitation centers, there should be a tremendous need for these. Now, in California alone, there are about 24 Raleigh Hills, Schick Seidel, CompCare. It's a big industry. He knocked on doors, and there was very little acceptance. Until finally, a fellow who had worked for one of these dry farms told him the secret. He said, you know, if somebody comes in here who has good insurance, we can run up about a $9,000 bill on laboratory tests alone, pathology, kidney tests, blood tests, you name it. He has to be in here for at least a week and a half to 14 days before we break even on our television advertising budget alone. We know that 75% of our business comes from recidivism, the person who gets glossed up, the family's happy, he goes back to work, will be back there. 75% of them will backslide within 6 months. You come in here with a device that will totally restore them in 5 days? Why, we are a franchise. We are here to make money for our stockholders. Get out of here, you bum. Now, fortunately, this company had spent a great deal of money in absolutely totally documenting the effects of this little device. They found that it reversed Korsakoff's psychosis in 3 to 5 days with chronic alcoholics. This work was done at the University of Wisconsin Medical School, at the University of Louisiana Medical College, and at the University of Texas. Now, any of you who have dealt with alcoholism know that it normally takes 8 years for the short-term memory to be restored, 8 years of total abstinence. The short-term memory profile of an alcoholic absolutely pinpoints the amount of degeneration. One of the tests is the maze test, where you have to go through a maze without lifting the pencil from the paper. The other is the beta section of a test, where you have to look at words on one page, the page is taken away, and you have to remember it on subsequent pages. An alcoholic will usually show a profile of almost total inability to pass these two facets of this particular assay. In all of their subjects, I don't like to say all, it's rather spooky, 99% of them, they were able, where they had a baseline of tests, for example, when the person had been to college, had taken this same or a similar test, had become an alcoholic for 15 years, where they had access to the original records, the short-term memory was totally restored in 5 days of using this little box 40 minutes a day. Now, this is wild and wonderful. All of this emerged during some of the research. I spent quite a bit of time in the Biomed Library at UCLA, some time at the Norris Library, USC County, and some of the papers, particularly the work done in the Soviet Union and in the Orient, were only available at the National Medical Archives at Bethesda, Maryland. But I have compiled a bibliography. It isn't in the final form, and any of you who are health professionals can get a copy of it. I'm still trying to get it on the word processor, and there's an explosion of information in electromedicine lately, as anyone knows, and I try to update it. So every week, my friends send me at least another dozen references on this particular topic. Now, it became apparent after spending a great deal of time with Meg that nothing was going to happen in this particular sector. She had her engineers come down to her little house on Fernleaf, and I spent many an afternoon with them explaining what I had found independently, explaining the difference between constant current and constant voltage, etc. The only device that Meg had brought to this country was the Pharmacon, which we were able to thoroughly instrument, analyze, and document. About the size of the original Sony Walkman tape recorder. And this is the device that was used on Peter Townshend when he was flown in on almost a hospital bed type airplane to the John Wayne Airport. He'd taken a massive dose of heroin before he left London, enough to get him to the States. He was absolutely green and yellow when they took him off the plane, and Meg put this device on his head. And within about 40 minutes, of course, all of you have read this story. It's been reprinted in Penthouse. It's been reprinted in Omni magazine. He was rehabilitated after having spent a fortune in various clinics around the world. Peter Townshend finally got off, kicked the habit, and is now happy, healthy, clean, producing again. All of this is history. At any rate, they were getting results with the device, as primitive as it was. And it began to appear that the neuroelectric therapy group, the magnet group, either was not going to produce anything, they were either unable or unwilling to do it. Now, this could lead to a great deal of speculation as to who got to whom. Whether the mafia was involved or some of the pharmaceutical houses or what have you. So I decided, well, let's research this thing a little bit further and bring out a box that will do some good, which I did. I gave away a number of these to friends and used them as guinea pigs. It worked. We feel it's vastly superior to the $50,000 Pharmacon device. But now, another very interesting thing happened. There had been an ongoing debate between Dr. Robert O. Becker, who was chief of orthopedic surgery at the Syracuse VA hospital, and a student of his, Dr. Andy Bassett, Columbia University, as to which frequencies would rehabilitate, rejuvenate, and grow limbs back on amputated mammals. How many of you are familiar with Robert O. Becker's work? Okay. Becker was using actually attached electrodes and putting current directly into the system. Now, he and I have chaired several conferences in Canada over the years. He's a brilliant man. He's rather bitter. At one time, he'd been nominated for the Nobel Prize for his work, but because he was a little bit outspoken, like some of the rest of our family, he got to enjoy a rather early retirement. He was also speaking out on the fact that the power lines were causing undue clusters of illness here in the eastern United States. But he had a student named Andy Bassett who has made millions of dollars on a device which has been accepted by the orthopedic mainstream ethical physicians, a little magnetic paddle which is put near the non-union fracture, which induces a current into that area by induction. Now here we have two separate approaches. We have a little ongoing discussion like Dr. Salk and Dr. Sabin. You can't get around either one of them without having him absolutely assassinate the other one, although both of them have a vaccine that works to a degree. This discussion became so heated that some funds were laundered and sent to Great Britain to find out just what was really going on. The results of this were reported for the first time publicly at a conference in Quebec last year by the principal investigator from Cambridge, a person of female persuasion, by the way, who finally located the secret frequency that was causing the tissue to rejuvenate. The mechanism by which this happened was that some of the blood cells, the basophils, in going to a site which had been slightly abraded, in the case of a rat, they would amputate an extremity, put the electrode, the blood seepage would undifferentiate, go to the area and start growing the tissue which had been there originally, as though there had been some type of an architectural pattern that had restored the memory of the RNA DNA close to the site to reproduce the proper tissue. It didn't turn into kidney tissue or brain tissue or testicles. It turned into whatever happened to have been there before the amputation. Now, they ran many, many, many animal studies. They held the frequency constant and varied the waveform. They held the voltage constant and varied the frequency. They held the voltage and frequency constant and varied the pulse repetition rate. One of the three magic numbers was publicly disclosed at this conference a year ago last August in Canada. It was very much unsuspected. It was over 2 kilohertz. I can give it to this group, 2.72 kilohertz. When that particular frequency was in the shotgun effect of the device, the limb regrew. When it was filtered out, or when the slope of the curve was altered so that that frequency was not predominant, it didn't grow. Now, there are three other magic numbers which cause the rejuvenation, the healing, rapid re-stimulation of the neurotransmitters, and these were developed on another government grant program, and I'm not at liberty to tell you what they are, but they are in the little box that we built. We did very elaborate spectrum analysis work on all of the units that we could beg, borrow, or steal. These are computer printouts, spectrum analysis sheets of over 24 brain tuners, acuscopes, acustims, myomatics, the Great Wall device from China, the Shackman instrument device, the Pharmacon unit from England. We could go down the list on and on and on and on. We found that the majority of these devices were sort of hit or miss. They didn't have the magic numbers, but they had enough fairly rough harmonics. You know, it's so ridiculous for the people selling these devices to claim certain frequency effects. How many engineers do we have here? Well, you've played around with radio. Frequency is a useful term only if you're dealing with coherent waveforms, such as a sine wave. If you have a square wave, by definition, a square wave has an infinite number of odd harmonics, right? That's what a square wave is. So that means if you put a 10 hertz square wave into somebody, you have every other odd harmonic of that from DC to light if it passes the system. Is that correct? So here are people putting out square wave boxes that they say will tune from X number of hertz to X number of hertz, and they're looking at the pulse repetition rates and confusing them with the frequencies. Now these are things that we find absolutely abhorrent. But since all these devices were copied from Tom Wing's Myomatic of many years ago, the spin-off of the Myomatic was the Acuscope. The spin-off of the Acuscope was the Acustim. This apocrypha continues to repeat itself over and over in the trade. Well, we hope that in these years where more and more people are talking about electronic medicine, which has to be the medicine of the future, that some of these basic misconceptions will be clarified. Well, at any rate, 5 months after Paul had said, why don't you meet Meg and find out if there's anything we can do to speed this up? By the way, Meg's reason for not accepting the government's offer was that she wanted an entirely new category. And Paul had conveyed to her that if you will come in under the grandfather clause, get you approval by the FDA, which will permit human and animal experimentation. And Meg absolutely, totally refused to do this. She wanted a new category for neuroelectric therapy, not realizing that this category had been preempted by CES, which is cranial electrostimulation, and a long list of other generic terms. We tried to explain to Meg that since Reagan, there are only under 300 investigators still working for the Food and Drug Administration, and this is an accurate figure. There are over 80,000 devices awaiting their investigation and approval. If you have another $5 to $6 million and 10 years to wait, even if we get you at the front of the list, it's not going to fly. But she absolutely insisted that she would not come in under the grandfather clause for a TENS unit, which incidentally is how you people are legal, and the Acuscope is legal. Although these devices do a great deal more than any TENS unit, they cannot make claims for what they actually do because this would put them in a new category. And this means human and animal tests, certification, all of this research that goes on and on and on and takes a tremendous amount of money. So we began experimenting in earnest. Thank God I had access to an IQS Model 401IL spectrum analyzer, which is probably the most advanced thing that I could get my hands on for under $50,000 for that Hewlett-Packard. And then we began looking at these frequencies in earnest. We eliminated the need for ever tuning the device. How many of you are familiar with the Acuscope? I'm going to use this as an example. Jerry Fisher, like the rest of us, realized that perhaps the most innocent people with whom you can deal are medical doctors. And here are these two dials that have various frequency settings. And the doctors very seldom read instructions. So Jerry came up with a marvelous idea. I got some different colored Scotch stick-on masking tape and cut little dots that are red and orange and green and yellow and paste these dots on the dial. We can tell the doctor, match up the yellow dot with the yellow dot. And this made it almost idiot-proof. And so instead of talking specific frequencies, which is ridiculous when you're dealing with anything other than sine waves, you match the dots. And he would come back months later and find that the device was still set on the same dots as when he walked out of the office and it was working fine, so everybody was happy. All of this apocrypha is now being replaced by hard science in these conferences. I've attended a number of them. It says electricity is the thing which makes you better, etc., etc. Well, at any rate, this was the political state of affairs in 1983 when a lot of people who did not know the difference between frequency and pulse repetition rate and had never heard of heterodynes and harmonics were looking for the Holy Grail. The way they normally did this, they would put the box on the dope addict and they would just juggle a dial and say, how does this feel? How does this feel? How does this feel? It was a fairly empirical process. How many of you read the Omni article in January 73? Okay. 83, I'm sorry. you notice there that the main secret of making the person better was to twiddle the knob, because at that time they did not know what the frequencies were. It has been fairly well established that the beta endorphins are stimulated with a pulse repetition rate of between 90 and 111 hertz, the catecholamine at around 4 hertz, the enkephalin at another number, etc., etc. This work has been very well documented and very well replicated by a number of scientific laboratories. So what we decided to do in our box was to put all of these frequencies simultaneously. Now, some people said, well, shouldn't you do one and then another and then another? And it's turned out not to be this way at all. If you have a high-Q circuit, you can put white noise into it and ring the filters, right? And the brain is an exceedingly high-Q circuit. It appears to have a Q in certain of the neuronal constructs of around 3,000, which is amazingly high. Pardon me?
Q is again what?
The figure of merit. Q means the bandpass versus the energy required. A crystal set will get all the radio stations in the area at once. A super heterodyne or TRF will get narrower and narrower bandwidth. If you have a triple or double conversion super heterodyne, you can separate two stations that are within a kilohertz of each other. The difference between those is the Q of the circuit, which is tuning to the signal. The higher the Q, the lower the bandpass, the less the interference. So we developed a system. We broke the price barrier. Most of these things sold from $5,000 up, that had everything in it that was necessary for the brain to rehabilitate its own production of neurotransmitters. In the meantime, we had found about 200 pounds of literature, at least I have that many boxes full of Xerox material, that friends had sent me, literally cardboard cartons. My filing system is abysmal. I'm very creative. I just pile it in boxes and hope I can find it later. Of the work that had been done, absolutely establishing that any stress-related syndrome, and this is why the psychologists hate this device, the stress-related symptoms that are recognized are insomnia, addiction, anxiety, and depression. That about 95% of the people who use these devices for a period of less than a month find complete reversal of these, and here the psychologists had been talking to them for years at $50 to $75 an hour. The pharmacologists had been giving them mood-elevating, depressing, and altering drugs since the good old days of Milltown and into the more elaborate pharmacology. And here was a little box that, with a 98-cent transistor radio battery, would fix maybe 50 different people before the battery ran down and you had to replace it. That's about a half a cent a person. And so naturally, there was a great deal of resistance to this type of technology. So right now, there's this political hassle happening over the fact that even the Carnegie Report, as you were the study back at the turn of the century, tried to damn all of the electronic medicine that had been proven back in the 1890s to be highly effective. And you know who funded those studies. It's very much like the American tobacco industry saying that the link between lung cancer and smoking, there isn't any. It's just... So we could go on and on about this. Basically, that's what the device is. That's how I started to do it. I hated to see people being charged $1,000 a day. And the thing just grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. I'm sure there are a lot of specific questions here and maybe a lot of other topics that we can discuss tonight.
I need to turn that a little bit more. I just wasn't concerned about the absence of data regarding the device. I was also concerned about the absence of data, supposedly, about the actual results of using this on drug addicts.
Okay, the results of this and drug addicts were generated in the United States several years before Meg learned about the device in Hong Kong. And the vast literature on this was funded by the Neuro Systems Incorporated group in Garland, Texas. The studies were done with, how many of you have heard of the Executive Monkey Study? Okay. This work was funded by the people who had brought this box out originally in 1970. This is before Dr. Nguyen had his serendipity, his accidental discovery with the heroin addicts in Hong Kong. I didn't realize that you could give monkeys ulcers. But what they had done is to aggravate them enough to where they had ulcers, put the device on their acupuncture points. They found that within about 3 days they had reversed the pH of the acidity and the monkeys got better, the control group. all of this work had been thoroughly done long before this current era of re-stimulation of interest. The rat studies had been done both in San Francisco and in Hong Kong. The chromatography had been done here in the United States, so it was well controlled. There is a wealth of information on this, and I'd be delighted to share the bibliography with you. Like electronic medicine, when we were looking at patents, we found a patent in 1893 showing a fellow with electrodes behind his ears. Did I show you that, Paul? Okay. 1893, before the Harrison Act, some 20-some years before the Harrison Act, you could go into any drugstore and buy morphine sulfate. Mothers whose babies cried could buy simple soothing syrup, which was sugar and morphine. She'd give a teaspoon to the baby, and the baby wouldn't cry anymore. There were quite a few addicts. The stuff was legal. There was no control. I mean, marijuana was legal. All the good stuff was legal. And after the act, a number of people who were trying to get off this had forgotten that around 1890, we had a hell of a lot more addicts in this country. The women who were religious were sipping tonic, which was about 200-proof alcohol for their health, taking bitters and what have you. In other words, we had about the same addiction level, and this work had been explored about 84, 85 years ago, and then again suppressed by what we feel is the ruling class of the doctors, the pharmacies, and the people who want to take your money for making you better. So if you're interested, we have this vast literature. We have a bibliography. We have a patent list. Fisher, no relation to Jerry, had done this work in 1932 and 35 and had a number of patents. Remember the Fisher Instrument Company that was making electrical stimulating devices back there 40 years ago or so? Okay, this has been in the literature. They had explored in great depth the waveforms, the frequencies, the application mode. A number of others have replicated the work I did in 1973. In 1969, I began building ethical biofeedback equipment, EEG, brainwave amplifiers. And I had one foot on each banana peel. I had been a scientist. I'm now a kook. So we sort of straddle this chasm. So I have taught biofeedback at classes at UCLA, USC, Villanova, University of Hawaii, SMU. And when I was doing this for health professionals, I also had access to the psychic underground. In Hawaii, I was able to make brainwave recordings of one of the three living bloodline Polynesian kahunas, Morna Simeona. There's Sam Lono, Morna Simeona, and another fellow on the main island, and then there are all these thousands of pretenders, the Daddy Bray, Gordon. I'd rather not go into that. I was able to make brainwave EEG recordings of Hexenmeisters, like John Ott in Lancaster County, no relation to the fellow who did the work on light and color. I have worked with American Indian medicine men. I've worked Catherine Kuhlman before she died, let me run a little telemetry test when she was knocking him down at the Shrine Auditorium. We found almost invariably that when they were in their working state, which was only a few seconds, you don't need it. You're here, you get the information, you come back, you can talk about it for hours. It's a flash in the twinkling of an eye. They were showing about a 7.83 hertz, almost pure coherent, maybe 20 microvolt signal frontal to occipital midline. That's between F1, F2 in the standard nomenclature system to between halfway between O1, O2 if you're an encephalographer. In other words, the third eye to the inion, which shows whole brain alpha. And over again, we found these frequencies in people with remarkable talents, healers, radionics operators, dowsers, shamans, witch doctors, mystics, Golden Dawn priests and priestesses, if they were authentic. I was intrigued enough with this that if this were the common denominator, and yet none of these persons would speak to any to the others, Catherine Kuhlman thought it was the blood of the Lamb, that Christ has died for your sins, and that's the only way to go. And some of the American Indian medicine men thought it was in the sacred cornmeal, the gourds and the feathers, and Morna Simeona had certain stones that were the dwelling place of the ancestral spirits. Well, Catherine would think that was heathen. And Morna would absolutely laugh at a fellow in a barn in Lancaster County wearing a black hat between midnight and dawn, drawing these hexagonal figures, hexen seagulls, to bless the barns. None of these people would speak to one another, but they were all showing the same signature. Now, the amazing thing about this is that 7.8 hertz is the mean median mode frequency of the Schumann resonance, or the Earth ionosphere cavity resonance, this little magnetic signal that's been dubbed the Earth's brainwave. So after we'd seen it enough times, I developed very sensitive magnetometers, which I sell to the government for anti-submarine warfare, that would detect this Earth ionosphere cavity resonance, and in a few cases, not enough to make a solid scientific case, but enough to be extremely interesting anecdotally, we found that there was phase lock, both frequency, amplitude, etc., between that person's EEG signature and the Earth's brainwave itself. Now, this was heresy when I reported on it in 1973 and then did a more formal paper in 77.
It means
that some people with remarkable talents, maybe one in a thousand, are sensitive enough to tune to this cosmic clock. When they synchronize their brainwave with this signal, they can access information in the hologram, which is normally not accessible except in an altered state of consciousness. It is now fairly certain that the mind is a hologram. It acts holographically. If you cut a picture in half and throw half of it away, you've lost half the data. But if you cut half of your brain out, like we had a number of hydrocephales that had a brain about the size of a grape, and we had veterans coming back from Korea, Vietnam, etc., World War I and II, that had 90% of their brain missing, they hadn't forgotten 90% of their family. They had remembered every single person. It wasn't as though you had thrown half of the information away. So that suggested that the brain was processing information like a hologram. If you break that hologram into smaller and smaller pieces, you still have the whole picture, but in less detail. So as a metaphor only, if the person has, by dint of meditation, religious practice, taking sacred mushrooms, or whatever the person does, managed to hit that particular frequency in his brainwave pattern, it seems to make him more amenable to all of this information. Now, this is interesting because if our brain, our mind, is a hologram, and if you and you and you are existing right here, right now, you're part of it. Which means that if you can access what's in your mind, quantum physics says there's no reason why you can't access the whole thing. Thou art that. You are in the universe. The universe is in you. You are God. Whatever information is out there, you have just a little bitty slice of it. It isn't as sharp. It isn't as high a resolution as if you were everybody all at the same time. But you can do it, as any shaman or a person who's undergone any kind of mystical discipline, or the Monroe Institute, can demonstrate. In spite of all of the John Wheelers and Randy the Magician types, to the contrary. So what that means to us is that maybe that magic number, 7.83 hertz, is the place on the alpha-theta border. Alpha is from 8 to about, they used to say 14, we now say 12 and a half because there's a kappa in the gap. Theta is usually considered to be 4 to 7. So 8, or 7.83, is right there on that biphasic border between the alpha theta. We've known for years that theta might be the area where we access creativity. You recall that Thomas Edison, Bernard Baruch, many people would take a little cat nap when they were dealing with a particularly knotty problem. They would say, I will have the answer when I wake up, and usually they would. Well, the reason for that didn't emerge till many, many years after the death of these people who had been using this technique. A number of us use it today. When it was demonstrated that when you go to sleep, the hypnagogic state going from waking to sleeping, the hypnopompic coming up from sleep to normal consciousness, you pass through that